Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi from Brand Positive, a research, foresight, and strategy consultancy for corporates, agencies, and NGOs. I've spent 20 years working on catalytic projects around the world, and along the way have been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom are guests in this series, along with an array of other fascinating individuals. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, focused on innovation. My next book will focus on foresight. So, I hope you enjoy this podcast, which is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, a global leader in applying futures thinking to solve strategic challenges within organisations. But now, let me introduce today's guest. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Tom Lombardo, a director at the Center for Future Consciousness. He's also a fellow at the World Futures Studies Federation and editor of the Journal of Future Studies. We're also on either side of the Atlantic. So here I am in Brighton in England, and Tom's over in Glendale, Arizona. So lucky you, Tom. Hi, and how are you?
I'm doing fine, Sean. It's actually a rather cloudy day in Arizona, which is unusual. We're having a bit of a break from the sun and the heat today.
You have my sympathy. I imagined you being some sort of boiling hot environment in a nice way. I know, you know, back in the day, you got your PhD in psychology and philosophy, but it'd be fascinating to find out how you got into, if you say, the world of futures and how that path has been for you.
The seed was planted when I was a young child, about, I'd say, 10 to 12 years old, when I became fascinated with science fiction. And science fiction has been a lifelong interest of mine since watching early movies like The Time Machine and The War of the Worlds and Forbidden Planet, which were often about the future. And so I had that interest even before I went to college and got a degree in psych and philosophy. The interest stayed there in the background for decades, actually, until I came out to Arizona. And when I came out to Arizona, I was asked to create some kind of integrative course for undergraduate students. And the thought popped into my mind that, hey, we could do a course on the future. And so I actively became interested in reading about and researching what nonfiction writers had to say about the future. That's where I encountered the World Future Society, the World Future Study Federation, the Association of Professional Futurists, all of which are global organizations that I became members of. And so I was a self-taught futurist with an interest in science fiction, an interest in philosophy. And so over the last 25, 30 years, I have given lots of presentations on the future, attended lots of conferences, written 12 books revolving around the study of the future, and started doing webinars. And so I think basically since about 1995, 93, I've been an active futurist. And that's what I'm still doing today, 30 years later. But I was basically self-taught, although I got interested in it just simply by becoming fascinated with H.G. Wells and Jules Verne a long, long time ago.
Having written 12 books and having been studying and researching, talking about future and futures, obviously, for so many years. I mean, as a saying goes, for thousands of years, we've struggled to predict, control, manage, and understand the future. So when you're giving, for instance, a presentation about it, how do you contextualize and bracket what you're talking about? Because obviously, one could talk about the history of the future and futures thinking, and it could take within reason forever. So there's certain sort of points in the history of futures studies that you settle on as being pivotal moments, or what? How do you approach it?
Well, a couple basic things. Number one, humanity, since the beginning of recorded history, has been interested in the future, has been interested in anticipating and predicting it, has been interested in controlling and directing it. And that's very fundamental to the human mind. Long before there was anything like future studies, people had various ideas about where the future was going. Often they were mythically or religiously informed, inspired. But the human mind is unique in that, and this is the way I often begin things, unique in that we do have the capacity to set goals, imagine, think about, try to direct and guide the future. So this is a natural human inclination. It's a natural human interest. And we've been doing it for thousands of years. Item number one. Item number two is that at least for almost as long, we've been creating stories about the future, narratives, which we share with each other. And they've had an impact to different degrees on people's behavior, on society. And so when we come up to the present, I will usually tell people that the whole thrust of science fiction through the last couple centuries has had a really big impact on the way we collectively think about the future, much more so than any academic disciplines ever have. Another main point that I bring up is that even though we're definitely and always have been fascinated with the issue of the future, and we make lots of predictions about it, the future, fundamentally, we need to see as a adventure, as something where we have an irreducible element of uncertainty and surprise involved in it. So one prediction I always make about the future is that the future will surprise us. And that's sort of a contradictory prediction, in that what I'm saying is that there are going to be things that we don't anticipate, and we can be very sure that, in fact, those kinds of events will occur, the surprises, the unexpected factors. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't think about it, try to imagine it, try to guide it. There's a famous futurist who I was very good friends with. I think he probably took this quote from somebody else, but the quote went, failing to plan is planning to fail. That was from Wendell Bell, who was, as I mentioned, a famous world-renowned futurist. And so even if we can't be certain, even if there's going to be surprises, even if we have to always take that into account, and just as an insert in there before I finish that sentence, I am almost completely 99% convinced that anybody that will tell you that they are certain about the future is full of putting whatever expletive word you put in there. Okay. That doesn't happen. That isn't the case, et cetera. So even if that indeed, even if we can't be certain about it, even if we have to accept that, it's still more effective for lots of different reasons to try to conceptualize, imagine possible futures, think about how we would go about realizing them, set images, ideals, goals for the future. In the long run, that's a greater benefit than just simply throwing up our hands and saying that, oh, well, you can't know about the future, so let's just live day to day. Which in fact is kind of the, and I would argue this, the mentality of a baby, a child, an infant who doesn't think out ahead, who just simply lives in the present. So I'm definitely of the view that that the whole philosophy that's very popular today of trying to just appreciate the present, of living in the moment, is a primitive form of consciousness. And that it's not an effective form of consciousness. It doesn't lead to greater happiness. In fact, it's counterproductive. And so that's part of what I would say to people about the history of futures thinking, why futures thinking is integral to the human mind in a mature adult human mind, why it's of value, even though the future is inherently uncertain and open to all different possibilities. In fact, that's a good thing, you know, the adventure of it all. Although adventures have both an upside and a downside, because there's negative things that will happen as well as positive things that will happen that are surprises. But that gives you, that generates the excitement and thrill of having to live through the journey of time.
Through that journey of time, and I know you mentioned that, you know, we can go back to, you know, you can go back to the oracles, back to the sibyls, back to the prophets in terms of what they were looking to. You mentioned philosophy there. So when you're talking about philosophy, again, are there other specific philosophers that you perhaps land on, if you like, as your sort of favored list of philosophers through the ages who had a particularly dynamic and fascinating take on the futures that you would relate to?
Oh, well, there'll be quite a few. Just quickly, first of all, we have Aristotle, who did look at existence as a dynamic and developmental process. There was Lucretius early on, the Roman philosopher, who advocated for an evolutionary view of life and the universe. So things are not static, things transform, but in fact, they transform in a progressive evolutionary direction. Those are a couple from early on. I've always loved Spinoza, even though Spinoza, in a sense, was not evolutionary, but Spinoza at least took a big picture cosmic perspective on everything. And I think it's essential that one takes a big picture cosmic perspective on existence when thinking about the future. And Condorcet, who was a French writer philosopher who was beheaded for his ideas during the French Revolution, Condorcet believed in the infinite perfectibility of man, as he put it, even though that's a chauvinistic statement, it should be humans.
Yeah.
Condorcet was one of the early architects of French European Enlightenment and of the theory of progress. So Condorcet had a positive vision of the possibilities of the future as a philosopher, as a thinker. He believed things could get better, or things were getting better, actually. Now,
can I just ask, a slight aside, but why was he beheaded if he believed in progress in that way?
Yeah, I would have to go back and look, Sean.
Go back to the records. Yeah.
He was, if I'm not mistaken on my history, he was thrown in the clink for something he said or something he was proposing, and eventually his head was chopped off in a guillotine. Listeners, viewers can go ahead and check my history on that and find out why, in fact, Condorcet met that bitter end. But in fact, he did.
Perhaps he insulted Voltaire or something. So one of those.
Yeah. And Voltaire. Actually, Voltaire is another interesting character in all of this as a philosopher living about the same time, because although we remember Voltaire as a philosopher of the Enlightenment, Voltaire actually wrote some science fiction. And one of his famous pieces, Micromegas, was a narrative on extremely advanced alien beings visiting the Earth and observing how arrogant and simple-headed humanity was in our beliefs that we understood the whole scheme of things. But that's a little bit from the history of science fiction. The philosopher, though, coming more up to the present, who I would strongly connect with the study of the future, understanding the future, is a fellow countryman of yours, Olaf Stapleton, who lived in the 20th century. And Stapleton had a PhD in philosophy, but came to the decision that in order to most effectively communicate his ideas to the general population, that instead of writing philosophical texts, he would write narratives of the future that were informed by his philosophical and cosmic ideas. And so he wrote a series of science fiction novels, but that read like philosophical narratives that present a evolutionary and but also dramatic view of the future of humanity, the future of the universe, the future of intelligence in the universe on a massive scale. Now, in Last and First Men and Star Maker, as two significant pieces. I have to, though, mention, when you're asking about philosophers, yep, is that even though we don't think of him as a philosopher, H.G. Wells, who's a little bit earlier than Stapleton, was yep, a top-notch philosophical mind. And even though we might be familiar with his popular works like War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, The Island of Dr. Moreau, The Invisible Man, Wells had great historical, philosophical depth to him and wrote an amazing number of books that were non-fictional in nature, were grounded in, you know, a lot of significant scholarship, and laid out visions of ideal futures. Now, something I should mention in all of this is that in future studies, you can talk about, can you make predictions about the way the future is going to go? Okay, that's one approach. Or can you lay out different possibilities as opposed to one prediction? Or can you present what you would think to be preferable or ideal futures, in that it may not go this way, but this is the way we hope it would go. Okay. Yeah. Now, Wells did a whole series of books culminating in The Shape of Things to Come, which are ideal futures. They're grounded in a lot of research and historical and socio-political thinking, but at the same time, he lays out a future for humanity into the next couple centuries that he thinks would be the best way for things to go, the preferable way for things to go. He puts it in narrative form, but it's still a preferable future. Lots of, you know, there's been lots of writers, and they may not even call themselves futurists, who have presented preferable or desirable pathways for humanity in the future. We have them right now, too, for that matter. You know, people talking about how to restructure our priorities, how to change our relationship with the environment and the earth, how to change our social political thinking in ways that are desirable, that would make the world a better place. And people like Wells and Stapleton and other contemporary futurists, or even people who wouldn't identify themselves as futurists, they take that tack. Here's the way things should go. Here's our preferable direction. Problem is, to just put the period on the end of the paragraph here, problem is that we have a lot of ongoing debate, and always have, over what is the preferable future.
People
They argue, they fight wars about it, in fact. You know, so that's a little bit on philosophers. I probably could say more, but that's some on the philosophers.
It's so interesting. I thought it really interesting the point you're making there about H.G. Wells. And I think also wasn't one of the things I found fascinating about Wells was that, you know, he famously, well, one of the many famous things he did, I believe, was that an incredibly influential talk at the BBC when he spoke about the fact that there were endless amounts, of course, of professors of history, but there were no professors of foresight. And he said way back, way over 100 years ago, there should be professors of foresight. And I think it changed the debate in a huge way. Moving forward, and he also mentioned a lot other people like Arthur C. Clarke. Arthur C. Clarke, bizarrely, here's a bit of a weird one. He had a brother who was a farmer in the village where I spent part of my childhood. So okay. I met him when I was about 10 years old. Such a bizarre thing when he came back from Sri Lanka. But in terms of the incredible list of books that you highlight on your site, in terms of your favoured titles there, as you mentioned there, starting with Star Maker. But how do you just talk about another couple? I mean, one that I think seems to be endlessly referenced and has been over the last couple of years, for instance, and it comes in at number 34 on your list, is Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. Perhaps just a bit about that, because he just seemed to be just one of the people that really, really saw what was coming down the line. So perhaps you talk a bit about that, for instance.
Snow Crash was Neal Stephenson's first book to get a lot of public attention, acknowledgement. It was, in some people's minds, the ultimate cyberpunk novel. Came out in 92, I think. And coming in at number 34 in my list is pretty good.
it's a long list.
It's a long list, and there's been lots of books written about the future. But Snow Crash is very good because it's such a colorful and electrical and almost psychedelic novel of incredible imagination and energy. It's pretty clear, you know, when what's his face from Facebook talks about the metaverse. It was Stevenson who invented the metaverse in Snow Crash. Snow Crash mixes together computer technology, virtual reality, drugs, crazy characters, the mafia, and ancient Sumerian theories about the origin of languages into this very inventive vicarious experience you go through. And it has one of the most memorable endings, where a robotic dog named Fido becomes the hero of the novel. So it's a compelling and interesting and colorful vision of a near future, definitely cyberpunk in its nature, because we have a variety of street characters and skateboard riders and motorcyclists and the streets of the city mixed together with high tech and the various nefarious characters trying to manipulate things. So it's a very, very colorful tale. I would add in there, just to make an additional point about thinking about the future. I will propose, the reason why science fiction is so popular in the general population is because it creates stories and narratives about the future, which emotionally and personally, holistically engage the viewer and the reader. So instead of getting an abstract theory about the future, you get an exciting and colorful and emotionally jolting story about the future. And that makes it psychologically, socially, much more impactful, effective, on the reader, the viewer, the thinker, because it's stories, narratives, which move most effectively the human mind, human behavior. Snow Crash is a good example of a very detailed and realistic, but very colorful and exciting tale about the future. One of many, of course, but that's one. Yeah. And yes, okay. I definitely rate it very high. One of the best novels of the last 30 years. Although I would say that his follow-up novel, The Diamond Age, which goes into the possibilities of nanotechnology and not just virtual reality, is actually even a better novel about the future. Diamond Age, I have listed higher on my list of best science fiction novels than Snow Crash. But Snow Crash is very good. Yeah, okay. For sure.
But just give you a couple more. So I remember years ago, and just after he wrote this book, I interviewed him for Days of Confused magazine. So William Gibson, when he wrote Pattern Recognition, that seemed to, and which is, I think, it's just endlessly quoted, particularly in sort of in the world of advertising, apart from anything else. Mm-hmm. Just your take on Gibson and his impact.
Gibson is usually identified as the beginning of cyberpunk. With Neuromancer in the 1980s, okay? Gibson, though, as a writer, has never really grabbed me as powerfully as Stevenson has, or Bruce Sterling, also as a cyberpunk writer. And so even though people will throw up Neuromancer and throw up other novels that he's written, Gibson, I wouldn't say is one of my favorites. You know, I've read through Neuromancer at least twice, with the intent, let me read through it again to see if it, grabs me better than the first time, since of course people think it's such a great novel, one of the great science fiction novels of the 80s. And, It doesn't do as much for me as Snow Crash or Sterling's Schismatrics, which is, I think, a really good cyberpunk novel, or Rudy Rucker, who's a San Francisco based with his four novels together.
If you say he's a quadrilogy, just make quadrilogy, the word up.
Whatever it is. So there's other cyberpunk writers that I like better than Gibson. I just recently started watching The Peripheral, which they put on TV.
Yeah.
And, that didn't do too much for me either. Now I'm going to give it some more time and see what happens with it. Sorry to say, you know, I don't have anything fascinating or interesting.
No, entirely fine. One can go through this, the list at length, because it's such a fantastic list you have here. And obviously the depth of your knowledge is quite astonishing. So, I mean, two people that are, again, naturally endlessly quoted, but who had a very, very different viewpoint on where things could be going, were Huxley and Orwell. So yeah. Perhaps just give your view there on Brave New World and 1984.
Oh, yeah. Brave New World and 1984 are two of the most famous science fiction novels ever written. Now, people could say, oh, those are science fiction. Yes, indeed, they are science fiction. A way to summarize the two, which were written back in Brave New World in the 30s and then 84 in 1948 came out, are that Huxley envisions a world in which there is no pain, whereas Orwell envisions a future in which there is no pleasure. Whereas 1984 is a very depressive, nightmarish vision of the future. Brave New World, I believe, is a more jolting in ways, a vision of the future, because in Brave New World, the population almost voluntarily gives up its freedom, its creativity, its drive for improvement, its self-determination to the opportunity to be perpetually in a state of shallow bliss, okay? That is, we worry that, like in 1984 is the archetypal narrative on this, we worry that big powers will gain control of us and turn our society into a authoritarian, totalitarian system. That's 1984, that nightmare. But in Brave New World, the population sort of goes along with the whole thing. The world turns into the kind of image presented in Brave New World because the population is drawn into this world of unending superficial pleasure. So that's the thing we got to worry about. If you were to ask, is our society today moving more towards something like 1984 or Brave New World, you can present the argument that is moving more toward the kind of image created by Huxley in Brave New World. It's not that books will be banned in the future like in 1984, but rather, as in Brave New World, people won't want to read books anymore.
It's just such an interesting take on it. Others perhaps that people may be sort of less familiar with instantly. So things like Ringworld by Larry Niven, Francis Dick, so Man in the High Castle.
Okay, two different visions there, but quickly with each of them. Larry Niven was hard science fiction, very popular back in the 60s, 80s, and 90s. Ringworld was his most famous novel, high-tech outer space or space opera type of novel. The thing distinctive about Ringworld is Niven's creation and his imagination of this colossal technological structure that measures, I think, 300 million miles across in diameter, the Ringworld, that orbits a star. And so part of science fiction, and only part of it, can be stories that deal with incredible technological wonders in the future. And Ringworld is a good example of somebody envisioning a mind-boggling technological wonder. Now, I should note, though, that Olaf Stapleton, the philosopher, is actually the person who came up with the central idea of the Dyson sphere. And Dyson, the scientist astronomer, gives Stapleton credit. And Ringworld is a variation on the idea of a Dyson sphere, of a technologically constructed a surface that will surround a sun and be given light and warmth from that star, from that sun. That idea actually goes back to Stapleton. Now, Dick, on the other hand, Philip Dick, was a writer in, who was poor and struggling all through his life and wrote a tremendous amount of science fiction, informed by an incredibly brilliant mind that he had. But at the same time, Dick was borderline and increasingly toward his later life, definitively psychotic. And so Dick's science fiction is laced with madness, with hallucinatory and disquieting psychological realities. But Dick, and you mentioned The Man in the High Castle, which is a, they did it on TV the last couple of years. Yeah. But it was a great novel, an alternate reality novel, in which Germany and Japan win World War II and not the Allies. And so we have a different history that unfolds. And you bring that one up because one of the things Dick says about his writing is that he wants to question all of our fundamental beliefs about the nature of reality and the nature of who we are. He wants to throw everything into open possibility. So we think we believe in, we think we understand our history. We think we understand reality. Well, in The Man in the High Castle, he throws out this idea that Germany and Japan won World War II. Now, of course, we're going to say, no, they didn't win World War II. In the novel, in The Man in the High Castle, there is a woman who goes in search of the man in the high castle. And the man in the high castle is a character in the novel who writes a book in which he speculates that the Allies won World War II. And the woman eventually finds the man in the high castle, the writer, and confronts him on this and asks him, you imply in your book that indeed the Allies won World War II. That's the truth. And the writer responds, yes. Now, if you start to think out the logic of that novel, Dick is actually saying in The Man in the High Castle that even though we don't understand it, excuse me, let me take that back. Even though we believe that we won World War II, we really didn't. Now, it isn't so. It isn't just simply alternate reality. He's actually presented an argument that we're mistaken about the reality that we're in. And I would ask the reader, if you haven't read The Man in the High Castle, go read it, because I'm not going to give away the punchline here, because Dick has a reason for saying that the Allies really didn't win World War II. Okay. But Dick got increasingly crazy. He believed he was talking to alien minds. And then he died broke, having continued troubles with alcohol and with drugs. And then he becomes famous, increasingly famous after he's dead. And his novels are almost universally trippy in that if it's not one dimension of reality, it's something else that he throws into question and twists around in his novels. Of course, they did Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep as a movie, two movies, in fact, Blade Runner. But you got to read the book, because the book is crazier than the movies are. And one of his most famous novels, Ubik, which is maybe one of his, clearly one of his best, in which at the end, what gets thrown into question is who's dead and who's alive? Are you really alive? Maybe you're dead and you think you're alive, and maybe the people who you think are dead are really alive. So that's what Dick does. So he goes ontological on you.
In
that sense, he's metaphysical. In that sense, he's philosophical. It's not just simply high tech. It's rather, let's just throw out all mental constraints and let's imagine different possibilities that we would never consider as, and we would think of as being nonsensical or ridiculous. But he does a very good job of dealing with them, and he's a very smart writer. The guy has this very solid academic, philosophical, and streetwise education behind him.
Absolutely fascinating. I mean, by the way, I'm aware of time being against us, unfortunately, but it's been so interesting talking to you. Can I ask you perhaps just one other big question? And that is something that's often very much associated with futures thinking through the ages has been the concept of utopia. And perhaps, you know, one go over and back to Plato's Republic through to Marx and many others. Perhaps can you just give us your view, a viewpoint on how some of the big thinkers have viewed utopia and what it stands for.
Okay. As you rightly point out, you can trace utopian thinking back to Plato's Republic, which is 400 BC. People have created utopian visions over the last 2,000 years, many, many different kinds. Francis Bacon, The New Atlantis, of course, Utopia by Thomas More. You could generally think of utopian narratives as stories of ideal societies. Now, what constitutes an ideal society depends on the writer and the writer's values. And so one man, as Philip Jose Farmer, a science fiction writer, once said, one man's nightmare is another man's wet dream. Mm. So what one person will think of as ideal, another person will think of as holy hell. And so, in fact, Karl Popper, the 20th century philosopher of science, viewed the Republic by Plato as an authoritarian nightmare because it was extremely controlled and ordered and restrictive. Now, a fundamental issue in social political philosophy has been the debate between how much order do you want in a society versus how much freedom. And that's an ongoing tension. When you look at utopias through the ages have often been very ordered societies. But from our 21st century perspective, we might see that as a dystopia in that there's too much structure, too much order, too much constraint, and not enough individuality and freedom. And also, there's another problem, which is actually connected with the first one, is what we may think of as an ideal society today, we may change our minds 50 years from now, 100 years from now. So you can't present the notion that here's the ideal society for humanity, period, once and for all. Because in fact, we could undergo significant changes in the way we think. I will give H.G. Wells credit on this one, because in his novel, A Modern Utopia, he acknowledges in it that any viable utopia has to be in a perpetual state of evolution. It can't be static. It has to be transformative and changing. Okay, whatever we shoot for, whatever we consider ideal, we have to keep an open mind as to how that very ideal might change into something different. So whatever people in the 25th century would think of as an ideal society, from our point of view today, might in fact be hideous, flabbergasting, bizarre, strange. Okay, fine. Okay, so we got to grant that. Okay, now people could say it's not a good thing to think about utopias because there is no perfect society, blah, blah, blah. Okay, baloney on that one because it's important. Okay. It's important for us to try to envision better societies than those we live in today. We do that. That's what utopian thinking is. Try to imagine something better, something improved over what we presently have. Keeping in mind that we won't necessarily achieve it. There's going to be other people who think different than us on this. But in fact, these ideal visions provide us with guidance, inspiration. I mean, personally, I think the idea of I have certain tensions with green visions as ideal utopias. I have certain attentions on that one. I won't say that'll be enough. But that's a viable and interesting ideal for the future that people advocate for and try to realize and achieve. It gets, a part of the quality of wisdom is understanding that life gets complicated and so do ideals. One of the most famous dystopias was Yevgeny Ziamatin's We, written in Russia right around the time of the Russian Revolution. And it very much influenced Orwell and probably even Huxley in the writing of their dystopias. Mm-hmm. And Ziamatin presents what on the surface looks like an oppressive, authoritarian system, a society, but it becomes a bit ambiguous by the time you finish it. Is this something good or is this something bad? Just like with Brave New World. It's supposed to be dystopia, but by the time you're done reading it, especially at the end, where there's this debate over whether this is a good society, it's unclear. So you asked about utopias. We have to keep in mind, we keep writing dystopias too at the same time, which are warnings. We don't want to head in that direction. But as I mentioned, our ideas keep changing. It's good to have things that you are trying to avoid in your mind so you don't walk off the edge of the cliff. It's also good to have things that you shoot for so that you have ideals. But keep in mind that what's an ideal and what's a danger, it could transform over time. You could think differently over time about it. Here's one that is an unsettling issue on this issue, on this question of utopias and dystopias. We pretty much believe collectively that whatever future lies ahead of us, it would be better if humanity was still here versus we were gone. Now, you could ask the question, well, maybe we should evolve, maybe we will evolve into something beyond us that transcends us, something different than us. Maybe that would be a better kind of world. And I'm throwing it out as a maybe, you know? And somebody would say, well, that's terrible that humanity's gone. Well, maybe something better would come along to replace us. H.G. Wells got very depressed about that possibility, but at the same time acknowledged it. And by the time he was old, he had pretty well given up his faith in humanity, turning the world into a good place, and figured that in the end, something better than us is going to come along and replace us. So what is our ideal for the future? The transhumanists, who are a very powerful group of futurists, believe that we need to transcend humanity to something that is different, technologically augmented from us. Science fiction deals with lots of cases where biological life is transcended and evolves into technological life, technological consciousness. But yep. We worry about it at the same time. We worry that computers are going to get so smart, AI is going to get so smart, it's going to overpower us because we're too primitive to keep up with it. Shit, you know, the singularity is coming. Is that good? Is that bad? I'm just saying that's open to thinking about, that's open to possibilities, that's open to different interpretations of, is this utopian or is this dystopian?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So interesting. I think that also you mentioned one of those points that also think William MacCaskill talks about in What We Owe the Future, where he's sort of obviously a philosopher at Oxford Uni, about that idea of an entopia or a utopia, as he puts it, I think, you know, a good place. So, yeah. So interesting. So that is literally just the last couple of points. And actually, I just have to say, I think it's fascinating how only a few months ago at Davos, at the latest World Economic Forum meeting, the term of this year's Davos was the polycrisis, which they identified as basically the problems of the future effectively hitting the problems of the present. Really, really fascinating.
Yes.
But on that basis, I have to say, Tom, so in terms of a near future, what's coming up for you personally? What are you up to the moment and what's coming down the line?
Yeah, I'm doing a bunch of different things. I'm working on a book on the future evolution of consciousness. I'm doing that. I've done some books on future consciousness and things related, topics related to that. But when people comment on what's right with the world, what's wrong with the world, and come up with possible solutions for the future, a very common, very prevalent answer that is given is that humanity needs to evolve its mind, our minds, our conscious minds, that we need to enhance our wisdom. We need to enhance our psychology. We're great with technology. We're great with lots of other stuff, but in terms of our conscious minds, we're relatively primitive or backward, and that we need to move forward along that front. And so I'm doing a book on the future evolution of consciousness and what it would mean, because lots of people have talked about it for a long, long time. Not to dismiss technological enhancements, et cetera, but let's think about directions that our evolution of consciousness could take as a way to create a better world in which to live. That's one thing I'm doing.
Just a small theme.
Yeah, that's okay. I've been thinking about that one off and on for years. And I have a background in philosophy, so I've been interested in the idea of consciousness and the mind-body problem and what's the relationship between the human mind and the brain and all of psychological topics that come along with it. How does the environment influence us psychologically and vice versa? Yeah. So I've been around that territory a lot, trying to understand what consciousness is, what the human mind is, how has it got to the point it's at right now? How is it contributing to the kind of world that we live in and how we can transform and develop it further? And people throughout history have talked about this a lot. And talked about our ethical development too, that we need a good jolt of enhanced morality and ethics in us. Well, that's one project I've been working on. Another one is that I've started a history of science fiction, and I've done 3 volumes on it, and I want to complete that. I'm doing webinars on the entire history of science fiction. And they're up on YouTube now.
This is the a sort of fascinating one of them, Prometheus to the Martians. Fantastic title, has to be said.
I like that title, yes. Prometheus is a key figure in the beginning of science fiction, which I won't get into right now. But I start the history of science fiction with ancient myth, and Prometheus is a key ancient mythic narrative. But I've done 3 volumes, but I've only got up to just the beginning of 1940, and I've been doing webinars, and I'm almost finished with them, coming up to the second decade of the 21st century. And so I'm finishing up the webinars, which are a history of science fiction from ancient myth all the way up to the last decade, which bring in both the literature and bring in the cinema too, because this science fiction cinema has become a very pervasive phenomenon in our culture. And so I got to finish the books as well. But I've been doing the webinars, and the webinars are up on my YouTube channel, and they're almost finished. There's only one left to do, 1 decade left. This last decade of the 21st century. So that's the second project, and also probably going to be revitalizing my website, which has got a little outmoded and needs to be improved upon. but maybe infuse some new vision and some new energy in the Center for Future Consciousness. So that's what I'm doing right at the moment. Yeah.
So interesting. And I have to say, in terms of the history of science fiction, you mentioned sort of cinema there as one of these specific points. I suppose we've got a couple of years and it'll be near sort of 100 years, I suppose, since Lang's Metropolis, the evil robot.
Oh, yeah. Well, Metropolis is one of the all-time great science fiction movies and is probably the best silent science fiction movie. Although, you didn't know, Sean, maybe you do know this, science fiction movies go all the way back to the French movie producer, director, actor, Méliès, and where he adapted Jules Verne and H.G. Wells to some early, very, very early 20th century short little films that are very fascinating to watch. But science fiction cinema has exploded post-Star Wars era. There was lots of stuff before, but beginning in the mid to late 70s, science fiction cinema has become the most visible, biggest money-making genre of global cinema. We just had the new Avatar come out, which was beautiful and kind of a bit repetitious in its themes and its plot, but still a very beautiful movie. On the other hand, we had the a very fascinating and crazy Everything Everywhere All at Once. Which was science fiction. And actually, I believe, maybe I'll have to go check on this, is the first science fiction movie ever to win Best Picture of the Year. I could be wrong. Maybe there's something I'm missing back there. But science fiction cinema has really dominated the cinema since the time of Star Wars. The biggest money-making movies, by far, almost all of them have been science fiction, except for a few odd cases like Titanic and Jaws, et cetera.
Can I ask you in that case just one last really specific question on exactly that sort of area, should we say? So just your view on the film Logan's Run.
I enjoyed up to a point Logan's Run. When I've gone back to look at it years later, it does have the quality of being dated. In Logan's Run, we have this control, although at the same time, presumably ideal society of the future. The only little drawback is when you reach, I think it's 30 years of age, you have to commit suicide in this technological ceremony. The most fascinating thing in Logan's Run, I'm correct, I got the right movie, yes, I'm pretty sure I do, was Peter Ustinov playing the hermit who was living in the old Washington, D.C. Capitol. I thought he was an interesting character. At the time, I thought the movie was pretty interesting, but it had that same old plot again of, they're in this control society that looks great at first, and then you realize there's this real drawback to it, and then you got to escape from it, find a way out, and then at the end, miraculously, you produce this rebellion and this society, the system that it exists before, is overturned. And the value that's presented in there, which is presented over and over again, is this value of individual freedom, and that it's our freedom which gets threatened in all of these different visions that are dystopian, visions of the future, you know, and we want to preserve that freedom at all costs, you know, and you know, even if everybody's happy and everybody's lovey-dovey and everything else, we're really afraid of the, and really treat as the ultimate negative quality to human society, having a constricting authoritarian or totalitarian system that robs us of our freedom. That's what we're afraid of. And that's what we take as our ultimate value here, that we have to preserve that freedom. That's what we fought World War II over, presumably, was defending our freedom against tyranny. We're still arguing the same thing today. Authoritarian governmental systems, even if they're sugar-coated and give you lots of bread and circuses, are still bad. So, you know, freedom is the modern central value that has to be preserved. And if we lose it in the future, that's a bad thing, and we have to rebel and get it back again.
Wow. That's a place to end an amazing conversation. Perhaps it's bringing us there via sort of Kant to Karl Popper to Sartre. One of those. But I just enjoyed that conversation so much. It's been absolutely fascinating. I think no doubt all the listeners will also join in thinking that they're going to happy listen to you for a lot longer. But look, Tom, thank you so much. So to Tom Lobardo, director at the Center for Future Consciousness, fellow at the World Future Studies Federation and editor of the Journal of Future Studies, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for listening to The New Abnormal. This series is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, which helps clients become futures ready. Just so you know, the issues discussed in these podcasts also link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info. Please listen to previous conversations in the series with many other fascinating guests. But till next time, goodbye.